This is a Crestview Bible podcast. For more information, visit crestviewhutch.org.
You could almost say the soundtrack of bad days, whether a commercial or some montage showing lackluster moments of life, comes from Daniel Powder's 2005 song, Bad Day. You've all heard this jingle on a commercial. So here's some lyrics. You stand in line just to hit a new low. You're faking a smile with the coffee to go. You tell me your life's been way offline. You're falling to pieces every time, and I don't need no carrying on. And then we could all sing together, because you had a bad day. You're taking one down. You sing a sad song just to turn it around. You say you don't know. You tell me don't lie. You work at a smile, and you go for a ride. You had a bad day. The camera don't lie. You're coming back down, and you really don't mind. You had a bad day. You had a bad day. So do you need me to actually sing it? Do you know what I'm talking about? Okay. You had a bad day. So now part of what this song is getting at is how getting through rough stretches can happen by digging deep within, turning over a new leaf, looking on the bright side, and of course, getting coffee, right? That's how some of us manage through all the difficulties of life. These options can indeed help. But what are we to do, or where do we turn when the answers aren't coming? So when it's a bad day and there's nothing readily available, we just can't seem to break out of the funk. What is the bedrock that's establishing the foundation we're building on? I was just thinking about this, and just one of the things that I'm thinking about by way of application throughout this whole message was just the way lonely people feel. That, you know, what's the answer? Well, you know, just hang out with people. Well, what if they don't really feel like that? You know, so just lonely people, what do they do? I mean, just what do they do in those moments? I mean, sit in a coffee shop all by themselves and stare out the window? I mean, just think about this in the back of your mind as we're walking through all these things today. Maybe have in your mind a lonely person that you know, or maybe you struggle with loneliness. And I just want you to think about all that God's communicating in his word to come near you. So we're wrapping up our series in the book of Job today. Like I said, we need more than just a few bookends on this fantastic story. So we broke this into, I think, 8 or 9 weeks. We've considered many things that I don't even think we realized that these were even in the Bible. And of course, if you talk to Bible scholars, they're real quick to say, well, the book's not about suffering, to which I want to say, like, okay, like, I appreciate that. Suffering certainly looms large on every page of this book. It's an important part of this in all the chapters. And we've dug into this and we found help. We've also seen how Jesus is nearby, even though this is happening like way early. We don't even know the time frame. Is it happening maybe around the time of Abraham? Sometime then? We don't really know when it's happening, but we know it's early, and we've seen sights of Jesus. And that's been helpful to us. And it's also helped shape us as God's people. That's one of the pastoral concerns I had and why I wanted to come to this, because I don't want to be like those three friends. I don't want to reach the end of my life and like be reaching way hard to pat myself on the back about how awesome I was and telling the truth to people, when all the time God's saying, I got a problem with what you said. So we don't want to be there. So all those things have been true. We're going to see more of all those things today. Now, last time we were in this book, last week in Job 38 to 40, we heard Job's first gracious speech. I mean, God is the ultimate one who displays grace to his hearers. We heard him move in and give Job some answers to questions that Job had made. And God even offered to respond to any more questions that Job had. I mean, this is so, like, I want to say condescending of God. It's so gracious of him to come and say, okay, here's my answer to what you've asked. I'm coming and starting there. But then what else do you have? To which Job, you know, covered his mouth. So he physically covered his mouth with his hand and said he had nothing else to say. Yielded the balance of his time to the floor so that God could speak again. And that's where we're going to pick up in chapters 40 and 41. That God is going to say something in chapters 40 and 41 that is so astounding that Job is brought low in worship in chapter 42. So, I mean, I'm probably overstating it to say we're in for a real treat today, but what is God saying in these two chapters that is so moving that Job says, now I know. Now I know your heart. Now I get it. So there's something in for us, what God's communicating to someone who's hurting. And so I'm betting there's somebody in this room who's hurting. And you maybe just don't even know how to verbalize that. And so I want you to pay real close attention to what God's saying to encourage your heart. So my hope for you is that as you hear what God promises to Job, it would resonate in your heart and draw you away from putting so much confidence in yourself to find rest in him. We want you to look to God and find your rest there. He's the one who's making these promises. He's the one that's going to bring them to pass. And what a way to end. Who is your trust in? I mean, what a great final word in the book of Job. Who is your trust in? On whom do you rely when your life is breaking apart? And how might God help in those moments? So Jesus is a friend of sinners, and he comes near those who are suffering. His character is such that the prophecy that he would be a friend of sinners and a man acquainted with sorrows and grief, that can land on him. And we know, yes, that's exactly who he is. That's my king, as the preacher said, you know. That's our God. That's who he is. So if nothing else happens today, would you look to Jesus and find his work for you as a sufferer satisfying? That's where I'm wanting you to end up today. So we have plenty of work to do as we navigate three chapters. So join me as we see three gracious promises that God makes to sufferers. And let's begin by reading chapter 40, verses 6 through 8. So Job 40, verses 6 through 8. Here's what we read there. Then the Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind and said, "Dress for action like a man. I'll question you and you'll make it known to me. Will you even put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right?" So I'm going to stop there. This is God's word. Thanks be to God. So three gracious promises that God makes to sufferers. And right out of the gate here, the first promise he makes is God establishes his promises as he acts justly toward the helpless. He acts justly or righteously. You could put either word in there. He's going to act in a righteous way towards those who are helpless. And so right out of the gate here, verses 6 through 8, we have a similar introduction. Like if you put your finger here and then go back to chapter 38, it's a real similar introduction. And I made the case last week, and I'm not going to belabor all that again, that God isn't showing up to put the smackdown on. This isn't like WWE Raw with God as the feature fighter. You know, he's not coming to slam somebody and say, "Hey, dress like a man, big guy. You want to pull your britches up? Well, come talk to me." That's not what he's saying. That's not the heart that God has at all here. As much as he's drawing near to Job, to someone who's hurting, to show them grace. And the question at the end of verse 8 really shows the difference with how this speech is unique compared to the other one, where God asks, "Will you put me in the wrong? Will you condemn me that you may be in the right?" And that's really the issue. Whenever we talk about a position like being in the right, we're asking a question of justice. In the original language, the question to Job is, are you really right to break God's justice? God's saying, are you really right to break my justice? Are you really right to call me into question in this way? And that is the question that's been at the center of this debate for Job in a lot of these chapters, right? Is God just? Is he fair? And is he good? You know, does God really know what he's doing? That's really the question here. And of course, we as readers, we're sympathetic to Job because we know what happened behind the scenes in chapters 1 and 2. I came back to this again and again. As we're reading through the book, we know what happened in chapters 1 and 2. We know why Job is facing the suffering that he's facing. Job doesn't know that. Job wasn't in the portals of heaven when Satan came and said, "Hey, let me test my servant Job here." We know that. We know what's going on there. The three friends don't know that. And so we can deal with Job and his friends differently. One writer put it this way: Job has understandably but mistakenly interpreted his suffering such that either he is God's enemy or God is his. So he is God's enemy would be chapter 7, verse 12. God is his enemy would be chapter 16, verses 9 through 17. That's what Job said. And God is going to use his second speech to unmask the real enemy and to show Job how he will defeat it. This is going to open a much happier horizon in which, despite his terrible losses, Job is still innocent and God is still his friend. So as this speech opens up with God speaking, again, God is speaking in verse 6. How? How does God show up? What does it say there in your Bibles? The Lord answered Job out of the whirlwind. He's speaking out of the whirlwind. And so we're reminded again that God hasn't distanced himself from sufferers. So God's not like on a faraway land of make-believe, like hoping, well, I really hope the sufferers, the people who are really going through it, could get some help somehow. No, God is coming near. That's what the whirlwind image is communicating to us. We think about Jesus in the boat with his disciples, and the storm is raging. And Jesus is like, hey, storm, chill. And it's gone. I mean, peace, be still. This is what God's saying. This is what he's saying. He's coming in the whirlwind. He's coming to help a hurting one. And that continues in verses 9 through 14. So let me read that in verse 9. Have you an arm like God, and can you thunder with a voice like his? Adorn yourself with majesty and dignity. Clothe yourself with glory and splendor. Pour out the overflowings of your anger and look on everyone who's proud and abase him. Look on everyone who's proud and bring him low and tread down the wicked where they stand. Hide them all in the dust together. Bind their faces in the world below. Then will I also acknowledge to you that your own right hand can save you. So this is what's going on here. Like in verse 9, the mention of God's arm and his thunderous voice. You know, like this is how God is. He's majestic and glorious. Verse 10 mentions God's glorious splendor. So we're being drawn to these other Old Testament passages that show that God is radiating, as one writer said, a numinous, awesome glory as he goes to battle to save his people from powers, either human or supernatural, that would defeat or enslave them. And God's making all of this plain in this opening section, not to humiliate Job, but so that Job can conclude that God is just and good. Job needs to come on the other side of this and see God's for me, he's not against me. So wicked, like chapter 40, verse 12 says, wicked are the ones who fall under judgment. The wicked are the ones who are tread down where they stand, but not people like Job. So this opening section opens with God acting justly towards the helpless. He's going to move in and help those who can't help themselves. So God helps those who can't help themselves. And in here, God actually does that, right? This isn't just Poor Richard's Almanac. There's nothing Job can do to fix his situation. He needs God to intervene, and God does. God does what's right. He does what's just in this moment. It's his character. He comes and helps Job. And so our journey into justice, that's where we're headed. It's only just begun. So now, point two. I got to say, with point two, this is the second promise that God establishes for sufferers. So let me just give it to you. That God will defeat the supernatural evil he presently tolerates. God will defeat the supernatural evil he presently tolerates. So I got to say, this is maybe the most nerdy point of the whole book for me. I'm sorry. It's crazy. It's also the one that has, we just need to get into it. So we sat with Job in the dust. We've listened to his grief, and now we listen as Job gets an up-close tour of two terrifying monsters. Two terrifying monsters. So the first one is in verse 15 of chapter 40, where God says, behold, behemoth. Behold, behemoth. So let me read the whole verse, the whole section, beginning in verse 15. Behold, behemoth, which I made as I made you. He eats grass like an ox. Behold, his strength is in his loins, and his power in the muscles of his belly. He makes his tail stiff like a cedar, and sinews of his thighs are knit together. His bones are tubes of bronze. His limbs are like bars of iron. He is the first of the works of God. Let him who made him bring near his sword. For the mountains yield food for him, where all the wild beasts play. Under the lotus plant he lies, in the shelter of the reeds and in the marsh. For his shade the lotus trees cover him, the willows of the brook surround him. Behold, if the river is turbulent, he's not frightened. He's confident, though Jordan rushes against his mouth. Can one take him by his eyes or pierce his nose with a snare? So look at behemoth. Now, I would love if any of you are in this room and want to draw a picture of behemoth or leviathan. We're going to look at leviathan in a second. But this is what God's inviting us to do right now. Look at behemoth. God describes a big animal in a river for us, which makes a lot of people think that this is a hippo or the hippopotamus. That's a whole other thing. But this description is filled with rich, vivid Hebrew poetry. We have a majestic beast here. The mountains are yielding their food for this animal. And yet, in verse 19, we see that the Lord brings the sword against this creature. It's real interesting. The Lord brings the sword against this creature. Verse 19 is probably the key to understanding that. So it's going to help us make sense of what's going on here. And then in chapter 41, we leave looking at Behemoth to try our hand at hooking Leviathan. So look at beginning in chapter 41. We have 34 verses here. So I'm going to read this whole chapter. It's pretty amazing. We're trying to hook Leviathan. So verse 1 of chapter 41. Can you draw out Leviathan with a fish hook or press down his tongue with a cord? Can you put a rope in his nose or pierce his jaw with a hook? Will he make many pleas to you? Will he speak to you soft words? Will he make a covenant with you to make him for your servant forever? Will you play with him as with a bird, or will you put him on a leash for your girls? Will traders bargain over him? Will they divide him up among the merchants? Can you fill his skin with harpoons or his head with fishing spears? Lay your hands on him. Remember the battle. You will not do it again. Behold, the hope of man is false. He is laid low even at the sight of him. No one else is so fierce what he dares to stir him up. Who then is he who can stand before me? Who has first given to me that I should repay him? Whatever is under the whole heaven is mine. I will not keep silence concerning his limbs or his mighty strength or his goodly frame. Who can strip off his outer garment? Who would come near him with a bridle? Who can open the doors of his face? Around his teeth is terror. His back is made of rows of shields, shut up closely as with a seal. One is so near to the other that no air can come between them. They are joined one to another. They clasp each other and cannot be separated. His sneezings flash forth light, and his eyes are like the eyelids of the dawn. Are you guys reading this? This is amazing. Like, verse 19, out of his mouth go flaming torches. Sparks of fire leap forth. Is this Nessie? What are we talking about? Out of his nostrils come forth smoke as from a boiling pot and burning rushes. His breath kindles coals, and a flame comes from his mouth. In his neck abides strength, and terror dances before him. The folds of his flesh stick together, firmly cast on him and immovable. His heart is hard as stone, hard as the lower millstone. When he raises himself up, the mighty are afraid. At the crashing, they are beside themselves. Though the sword reaches him, it does not avail, nor the spear, the dart, or the javelin. He counts iron as straw and bronze as rotten wood. The arrow cannot make him flee. For him, sling stones are turned to stubble. Clubs are counted as stubble. He laughs at the rattle of javelins. His underparts are like sharp potsherds. He spreads himself like a threshing sledge on the mire. He makes his deep boil like a pot. He makes the sea like a pot of ointment. Behind him, he leaves a shining wake. One would think the deep to be white-haired. On earth, there is not his like, a creature without fear. He sees everything that is high. He is king over all the sons of pride. Yikes, what is this? Like, is that you, Santa Claus? I mean, what's going on? I mean, this is crazy. What's happening? A whopping 34 verses to describe this sea creature. And a lot of people think, well, we're talking about a crocodile. So Job mentions Leviathan back in chapter 3, verse 8. But God's description gives Job an up-close tour of this creature. So no other animal in the Bible is described with this kind of depth. It's just amazing. Like, what's going on here? There's no way that humans can there's no way that the way humans capture crocodiles could work with Leviathan. That's what this is telling us. In verse 9, to use like SportsCenter language, we're told that no one can stop him or hope to contain him. I mean, he's just going to do his thing. In verse 14, the teeth are full of terror, scales like armor in verses 15 through 17, lightning flashing out of his mouth in verses 18 through 21, glowing eyes in verse 18. Again, there's a more description. Weapons are useless, verses 26 through 28. And as the creature swims away, the water boils in verses 32 and 33. So what does this have to do with God's justice? That's weird. Why this description? Well, I think verse 10 is the key. Verse 10 unlocks it, just like the previous verse did for Behemoth. Verse 10 says, "No one is so fierce that he dares to stir him up. Who then is he who can stand before me?" Right? This is an amazing clue. Like, if humans are utterly helpless before this monster, then we are infinitely helpless before God. That's the point that we're being drawn to. That God has revealed all that he does about Leviathan so that we can understand God differently. So what do we make of these two animals? So if they're just two mere ordinary animals for Job to consider, God's presenting them in a really weird way. After all, God spoke of all the animal kingdom last week. Remember that? I said this is like a tour of Mutual of Omaha's wild kingdom. Like, what are, okay, so the unicorns, and look at how the ostriches are, and all this. That was last week's sermon. So that's one aspect. Further, if 40:24 and 41:1-7 don't make sense if we're just talking about ordinary animals like hippos and crocodiles. Like, Egyptians captured hippos and crocodiles. We know that. So reading these two descriptions, though, along the Old Testament theme of God showing up to defeat chaos, seems a lot more satisfying. If we think that this is how God acts for his people, he defeats chaos. And that's why I think Job's reaction is telling, because he finally gets it. So Job thought that God was attacking him for no reason, and now he learns that the person he's been criticizing is actually going to battle against a monster Job can barely imagine. So here's how one writer describes this. God is accomplishing two goals in the Behemoth and Leviathan speech. First, he reveals to Job the supernatural chaos and evil that God allows in this world, which is the source of suffering and pain. And at the same time, God's clarifying that an infinite divide exists between God the Creator and everything else in reality, whether Job himself or the ordinary animals from chapter 39, or those more sinister powers that rebel against God in chapters 40 and 41. And God promises that this supernatural evil that he tolerates will one day be put away. I mean, this is such good news. In other words, the one person who most clearly sees what's wrong with the world is the one person who promises he will not let it stay this way forever. There's coming a day when God will gloriously scour every last trace of evil from his world and make all things new. I mean, this is incredible. So one more quote. This is all from Eric Ortlund. I'm not this smart. Okay, just so you know. I don't want you walking out of here saying, "Man, I can't believe Phil figured that out." I didn't. I just read Eric Ortlund. Okay, one more quote. So this, of course, is a very different answer from the sorts of answers Christians typically give in response to inexplicable evil and suffering. Answers that are not wrong in themselves and certainly not without scriptural support. God says nothing here about all things working together for good. True as that is from Romans 8:28. He says nothing about guiding evil for his own good purposes, true as that is, according to Genesis 50, verse 20. He says nothing about the glories of the age to come overwhelming all the sufferings of this present age, true as that is, according to 2 Corinthians 4:17. He only tells Job that he is entirely aware of the problem, more so than Job could ever be, and he will one day defeat and destroy the evil he presently tolerates. That's what he's telling Job in these two pictures. That, yeah, I know there's evil out there. I mean, can you see them up close? Because I can. And one day I'm going to do away with all that. So that leads us into the third point. The summary. So now we get to the point. Because I think we need to be curious the whole time. What is driving Job now after this second speech to be drawn so low? To now be drawn in worship. Well, third, God is devoted to his people despite evil. He's devoted to his people despite evil. Job responds humbly. The pictures of Behemoth and Leviathan have had their effect. And Job responds in worship. He says, "Now I know." Then Job answered the Lord and said, "I know that you can do all things and that no purpose of yours can be thwarted. Who is this that hides counsel without knowledge? Therefore I have uttered what I did not understand, things too wonderfully for me which I did not know. Hear and I will speak. I will question you and will make it known to me. I had heard of you by the hearing of the ear, but now my eye sees you. Therefore I despise myself and repent in dust and ashes." So Job now knows that God works for his good regardless of how much he understands it or how much he sees it. He knows this, that God is a great warrior for Job, that God is the one who's marching out before him, fighting against the evil and chaos that threaten him, just like these behemoth and leviathan. God is fighting against them. He's the only one who can. He's the only one who can stand up to evil and have the final word. And verse 3 tells us, Job's admitting, I was in over my head. There are things that I didn't realize. There were things that were too wonderful for me, in verse 3. The speaking of things too wonderful is often used in the Bible to describe great acts of salvation accomplished by God to rescue his helpless people. So if we're going to jot down some references, Exodus 3, Joshua 3, Psalm 72, Psalm 77, Psalm 86, Psalm 98, Psalm 131, Psalm 136. In all these places, these things too wonderful for me to understand are things of salvation, of God coming near to save his people. And Job connects this concept to what God is going to do for him. And so in verses 4 and 5, Job quotes God's questions back to him. So it's basically a quote of Job 38:3 and Job 40, verse 7. That's what Job's saying in verses 4 and 5. And he's saying, now he's replying with these questions, saying, now I see you. You know, that's my favorite scene of Hook when, Marbles, or what's his name? Gosh. Says, who's saying he's not Peter Pan? You know, then he grabs his face and wiggles him down and stretches his mouth out and says, oh, there you are, Peter. That's what Job's saying here. Now I see you. Now I see you. It took me going through all this suffering. It took you speaking. It took you taking the initiative and promising that you're going to take care of all the evil in the world. It took me, but now I see you. Now I see you. In other words, now I know you're my friend. Now I know you're my help. Now I know that you're my all, and I will rest in you. So Job responds then by repenting in dust and ashes. Job's comforted by what God can do for him in a way that he wasn't before. He knows that God's going to swallow up all the losses that were too much for him. And notice just the timing of this, right? Job's heart is settled and perfectly content in God before anything else happens in this chapter. So a lot of us, we know that God's going to make good on those promises, but we would repent if he would just keep his end of the bargain, right? So I would say, now I see you, but can you vindicate me before my enemies? Can you restore everything now? And Job's saying, no, my heart is at home with you now. It doesn't matter what you can restore or not. You can vindicate me or not. My heart's at home in you now. I repent in dust and ashes. So Job's restoration isn't going to happen until 42:10, but his heart is at home here in verse 6. Even on the ash heap, even as he's looking at the graves of his children, even as he's still covered in sores, his heart is home. He's assured. Being assured that he matters to God is enough. That God's got me. That's enough for him. So in verses 7 through 9, we're reminded that our speaking to one another matters. So in the Lord, after the Lord had spoken these words to Job, the Lord spoke to Eliphaz the Temanite, my anger burns against you and against your two friends, for you have not spoken to me what is right as my servant Job has, which that's confusing in a whole other way. Like, we don't know that Job's got it right, but God's still vindicating Job before his friends. Now therefore, take 7 bulls and 7 rams and go to my servant Job and offer up a burnt offering for yourselves, and my servant Job shall pray for you, and I will accept his prayer not to deal with you according to your folly, for you have not spoken to me what is right as my servant Job has. So Eliphaz the Temanite, Bildad the Shuhite, and Zophar the Naamathite went and did what the Lord told them, and the Lord accepted Job's prayer. And 7 significant there, right? It's like, it's not just one sacrifice. Go offer a sacrifice. He's saying 7, like, you're going to need lots of help here. Like, I'm demanding, you know, that you're going to need a lot to make this right, but Job's going to pray for you, and it's going to be all right. So it's kind of an amazing thing. Just like God vindicated Job, he'll vindicate others like him who are going through Job-like suffering. So as the church, we need to be careful not to give advice that only hurts them. I think part of the issue is we tend to be too impressive with ourselves. We think that we know what another person needs. And as a result, we try to fix them in a way that only deepens their pain. And the ending of Job gives us a lot more caution in this regard. Now, I know I've hammered this. Probably every sermon we've had some sort of application like, oh, be careful, little mouths, what you say to those who are hurting. I mean, we've had this application almost week in and week out. And I think maybe the way I could state it positively would be, might we be so enraptured with God and his kindness to the hurting that we'd be cautious when we come alongside them? Like, I don't want to get in the way of what God's doing to restore someone. I don't want to fumble some stupid words and drop the ball, you know, whatever. I want him to be the one who's doing the restoration. So it's also a good reminder that even if you mess up or you think back and you have condemnation over some way that you did mess up, that God still wants you to. Like God comes after these that have blown it and says, hey, Job, just pray for them. I want them too. I long for them too. Even when we mess up, God creates the way for these friends to be restored. So if you're thinking and you're thinking, oh man, I've made horrible mistakes and I haven't said things that have been helpful. It's okay, God still wants you. He's still made a way for you to be restored too. We all need a sacrifice and there's been one given for us. It's good news. And this leads us to the big finish where God restores sufferers purposefully. So let's see how this fairy tale ends, kind of. It's an amazing ending. And the Lord restored the fortunes of Job when he had prayed for his friends. And the Lord gave Job twice as much as he had before. Then came to him all his brothers and sisters and all who had known him before and ate bread with him in his house. And they showed him sympathy and comforted him for all the evil that the Lord had brought upon him. And each of them gave him a piece of money and a ring of gold. And the Lord blessed the latter days of Job more than the beginning. And he had 14,000 sheep, 6,000 camels, 1,000 yoke of oxen, and 1,000 female donkeys. He also had 7 sons and 3 daughters. And he called the name of the first daughter Jemima, and the name of the second Keziah, and the name of the third Karen Hapuk. And in all the land there were no women so beautiful as Job's daughters, and their father gave them an inheritance among their brothers. And after this, Job lived 140 years and saw his sons and his sons' sons, 4 generations. And Job died an old man and full of days. Amazing. God opens the heavens and rains down goodness upon Job, even double what he had initially. One writer pointed out that infant mortality rates were tragically high in the ancient world, so holding one's grandchildren would have been a blessing. But Job was enjoying his great-grandchildren. In other words, just God smiling. So this is a biblical way of saying that Job enjoyed a fairy tale level of blessing after his trial. God allowed Job to suffer in about every way possible during this ordeal. Now he withholds no blessing that is his to give. I mean, this is the character of God and his heart for you. This is what he's promised us. And we have another example here in the Bible. There's so many. Another example of how the worldview of the Bible exalts women. Job gives his daughters an inheritance along with the sons. This would be unheard of. It always, typically the inheritance ran through the male line. And because Job understands that suffering is sometimes allowed by God, Job does what he can to help potential widows and orphans. He sets up an inheritance for them. He does, as James 1:27, he does what that religion that is right in the sight of God. And so how might God be blessing you to help the helpless? God's devoted to his people despite evil's existence. I mean, this is so incredible. We can not only know this, but we can allow this to shape us. We can allow it to shape how we speak to one another in a way that's fitting and how we can give grace to others. So we relate to others in this confidence that God will restore in one way or the other. I know some of you are thinking, so are you saying that if I endure suffering that God's going to restore all this? And I think what I'm saying is, yes, someday. I think someday we're going to lay our crowns at the feet of Jesus, and it's going to be so much glory to him. And we're going to have so many blessings for all of eternity that we're going to not be able to comprehend. Now, God may allow some of that wealth to come to you, some of that blessing to come to you in this side of heaven. I don't know what God's heart is, but I do know that it's kind of like Daniel's friends in the fire, right? We know that God's going to deliver us. We may go through the fire and get burned, but he's going to deliver us. This is not the end. Right, God's got this. And I'm saying suffering is not the end of your story. God will restore you. It might be eternity, but he's going to restore you. It's going to be enveloped in the greater glory of all that he's working through resurrection, all that he's working to raise you, all that he's working to redeem all that Christ has purchased back that evil has destroyed. He will restore that. So in conclusion, I know we need to wrap and I'm going long. Three gracious promises that God makes to sufferers: that God acts justly towards the helpless, God will defeat the supernatural evil he presently tolerates, and God's devoted to his people despite evil. So we've gone after three key words, three themes in this series: suffering, the church, and Jesus. We've done some work to get through this book, and now that we finish, we're seeing these themes again. Jesus. Jesus is the face of all that we've seen today. He's the one who came and embodied God's heart for sinners and sufferers. He showed us, Jesus showed us, that God's intention toward the helpless is to come near them and to do what's right to them. I mean, Jesus' death on the cross embodied God's defeat of evil that he presently tolerates. I mean, he defeated it. It's over. He's conquered. And his resurrection was just kind of the exclamation point, dropped the mic drop of history, like, I've got this, it's over, I've won. This is what Jesus has done for us through his life, death, and resurrection. He's conquered. I mean, this is, Jesus also shows us that God is devoted to his people. And so about that restoration that's coming, Revelation 21 speaks of that, these eternal realities that are ours because of Jesus. Revelation 21, behold, the dwelling place of God is with man. He will dwell with them. They will be his people, and God himself will be their God. He will wipe away every tear from their eyes. The suffering will be no more. Death will be no more. Neither shall there be mourning, nor crying, nor pain anymore. For those former things have passed away. And then a voice came from heaven, the Father, the one on the throne, says, behold, I am making all things new. He will restore, and he will do this through Jesus. He will do this through Jesus. This passage provides hope for all of us who trust in Jesus. So will you turn from your sin and trust him by faith? Will you lean into him? And if you're a believer, I hope you're encouraged. This life is going to be filled with evil, suffering, discouragements, persecution, but God is greater. We can have confidence in his justice. We have confidence in his justice. He will right the wrongs, and he will make all things new. This is written into the fabric of the scriptures. Evil will be tolerated. Evil that might be even tolerated now will be defeated in the end. And he will be devoted to his people. He will be with us, even to the end of the age. I mean, that's what Jesus said, I'm with you, even to the end of the age. So let's not doubt that. I mean, I think that's part of what got Job into trouble. I think that's why Job has to repent in dust and ashes, because he had just forgotten that God's gonna be with me, that God's not working in me for evil, he's working in me for good. So lean into him and lean into others out of that. Like, if you're sure of that, lean into others with confidence. Yeah, let's not overestimate the role we have in the lives of others, but let's speak and encourage people. Let's consider how we can relate to them, knowing that we serve a God that loves the hurting, that he's near them, that he's near the brokenhearted. And yes, weeping may endure for a night, but joy is coming in the morning. He will restore this. He will make all things new. I mentioned at the beginning, just thinking about someone who's dealing with loneliness, and here at the end, I mean, do you see the answer? Like, don't give up on God. He's with you if you're alone. If you feel lonely, like nobody loves you, nobody cares for you. I think you're going through one of these dark nights of the soul like Job's going through here. And he's saying, look at these beasts. Look at, am I not going to do what's right by them? And am I not going to do right for you? I'm not leaving you alone. Look at me. Look at the wonderful things I've done for you. Look at the salvation I'm bringing to you. So if you're lonely, look there. Look there. Look to Christ. Look to all that God's done for you through Jesus. I get it, man. I didn't get married until I was nearly 30. I get what some of those lonely days are like. And just, what do I have to do to make someone like me? What do I have to do? And I'm appealing to you. God likes you. God likes you. He likes you a lot. He's not abandoned you. So, weeping may endure for a night, but joy is coming. If you're united to Christ, there's a resurrection coming. You might have to go with him into the depths, but he will raise. He will. You will be raised with him. I mean, this is great joy for us. So, would we fall into him with faith? I think that's the response, to trust this. You know, trust him. You're with me. You've not abandoned me. I trust you. So lean into him with faith and make him known to others that we might glorify and enjoy him forever.